This week, the Bulls were in charge of Wall Street and the COMEX as a gold short covering rally sent the metal higher by $28. Silver picked up 50 cents. The precious metal stock shot into orbit and U.S. equities added to recent gains. Well, hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be back with you this weekend. Following a Thanksgiving sabbatical, your host, Chris Waltzek, another two big guests lined up, and Robert Ian in store for you this weekend. Well, the late summer market volatility in U.S. stocks rattled a lot of investors, but with many pundits once again calling for an end of the world scenario, my guest and I, we don't share this perspective and wonder if investor skittishness might be a positive contrarian sign. Could the herd have it wrong? Joining me, best-selling author and economist Dr. Stephen Lieb. Our forecasts finally came true. The yuan gained reserve currency status this week. That's going to change the global monetary structure. He thinks that eventually this could really encourage the bulls. The news certainly put a lot of downward pressure on the greenback. Then Dr. Chris Martinson joins the show from Peak Prosperity. He's just put out a must-read tome called Prosper. He's concerned about economic deflation, where insufficient money and credit could lead to big debt implosions. But the wealth-preserving properties of gold and silver, as well as their shares, will regain their status as the investments du jour. And we discuss some alternative healing methods for every listener. Then Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest must-hear report. And we'd like for you to call into our toll-free hotline. That's 1-206-666-65-370. Please jot it down on a Post-it pad or plug it right into your phone. 1-206-666-65-370. You can call in with your questions and comments. You can remain anonymous if you prefer, or leave your first name. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather recap. Visibility was virtually unlimited over the New York COMEX exchange following six gloomy weeks amid so-so U.S. employment data. Investors were pleased with the mediocre domestic unemployment numbers, which suggest the Fed may be less aggressive with its upcoming expected rate hike in about 2 weeks. Gold picked up $28, finishing at $10.84 an ounce. Silver picked up 46 cents, 3.3% for the week, ending at $14.53 an ounce. The XAU Gold and Silver's Equities Index picked up 5 points, blasting higher by 11.2%, finishing near 50. But West Texas Intermediate crude bucked the trend down 4%, just under $40 per barrel, the lowest weekly close in several years. Unfortunately, the head and shoulders pattern is nearly complete, suggesting there could be a major drop to as low as 20 in the next 6 months. In related news, gold added to gains on Thursday following comments by the European Central Bank to cut its deposit facility from 0.003 down to negative 0.002, and that represents about a half of a percentage drop. But more importantly, the first time the rate has fallen into negative territory, this is just one more negative EU rate. Additional economic stimulus measures were less intensive than anticipated. The ECB president was a bit less hawkish, which strengthened the euro to the detriment of the U.S. dollar, which was a good recipe for gold prices. Another news event that certainly hurt the greenback, news that the yuan had been added to the basket of reserve currencies, the SDR, the greenback fell from recent monthly highs. According to one media source, analysts noted an improved correlation between precious metals and the dollar, as investors are anticipating the first Fed rate hike in a decade. The next FOMC meeting is slated for December 15th and 16th, and the current Fed funds futures contract implied probabilities indicate nearly 80% odds of a quarter point rate hike in the next 12 days. My model suggests that a very high probability of a full point rate hike by the end of next year. And that against the backdrop of comments from Fed Chair Janet Yellen and the voting Fed governors, who continue to imply solid economic conditions warrant higher rates to prevent inflation. This week, on December 3rd, Dr. Yellen gave a cautious, upbeat speech for the U.S. economy, signaling that conditions were necessary for an interest rate hike. precious metals, bottom line. Well, gold stocks continued to hold up as investors direct profits into top gold companies like Newmont Mines and Seabridge, both of which blasted 17 to 18% higher this week. Seabridge, of course, a Gold Seek sponsor, one of our favorites, up 200%, threefold from the recent lows since just July, besting the XAU by over 7%. I expect solid buying opportunities to continue to unfold. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, mostly sunny skies appeared over the New York Stock Exchange on slightly better than anticipated numbers from the Labor Department, which provided a Goldilocks-like scenario where economic conditions are improving, but at just the right pace to keep the Fed from any aggressive rate hikes. The Dow held above the 17,000 threshold, ending near 17,847, while the S&P 500 ended at 2091, up 1.6 points fractionally, and the Nasdaq added less than half a point, finishing at 5142. Meanwhile, according to a Friday report from the U.S. Labor Department, the unemployment rate held at a seven-year low of 5%. The economy added more jobs in November than anticipated, boosting the case for a Federal Reserve rate hike, but at a more measured pace. The news was an orchestral piece to the ears of gold aficionados. The 211,000 increase was about 11% more in non-farm payrolls than the median forecast of 200,000 anticipated by analysts. The figure came on the heels of a substantially higher gain of 298,000 in last month's reading. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, our seven-component sentiment index continues to hold in the neutral territory, suggesting some indecision on the part of investors, which makes sense ahead of what might be the most closely watched rate hike in a decade. Nevertheless, price action in the indices continues to be positive as all three major U.S. bourses have recouped this summer month losses and appear poised for a new advance and new records in the coming months. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with Drs. Stephen Leib and Chris Martinson. We'd like for you to stay with us right here. Dr. Chris Martinson, big economic researcher, futurist dealing with energy, resources, and I might add, one of our favorites, and that's natural health healing. Welcome, Dr. Martinson.
Why, thank you. It's a real pleasure to be back.
I'd like to start off, I think, with what we usually end the discussion with, this idea that maybe modern medicine has missed the boat on a few key areas, and that, and particularly when it has to deal with chronic health issues such as diabetes, Alzheimer's, so many diseases that people are terrified of, even cancer. We find that the mainline, the mainstream medical community has a really difficult time not only A, grappling with, but treating. And it seems to be as though there are a couple of components here that take more than just a magic bullet, that take more than just a magic elixir or panacea. Some of these things require entire lifestyle, dietary changes on really big scale, and it's doable, but within the context of modern society, it can be really challenging. And I'd like your thoughts.
Wow, where do I start? I have so many thoughts in this. This is an area I am increasingly researching and understanding and talking. And you know as well as I that you know, if you look at the large data for the United States, but you could extend this globally too, it's a pattern of increasingly poor health and health outcomes. Obesity, chronic issues, things that were really fringe problems a number of decades ago are now common. All sorts of food allergies. Where did these suddenly pop up? You know, just the obesity epidemic, on and on and on and on. There's clearly something wrong. And this is something we talk about in our new book, Prosper, is that 80% and 90% of almost everything that ails people starts and is treated in the kitchen. It begins with your nutrition. It begins with making sure that the things you're putting into your body are not hurting you, either directly because it's toxic, it's got pesticides, it's got herbicides, it's got mycotoxins, it's something like that, but even more indirectly because you're eating things that are constantly causing your body to go into a little bit of a panic, creates inflammation, starts fighting this invader you've eaten, and unfortunately fights the invader in things that look like the invader, which could be the linings of your blood vessels, it could be your nerves, it could be all kinds of things. So really, it begins there. You know, there is no magic pill. You don't go to the doctor and they cure you. It all begins with your lifestyle, your choices, the decisions you make. And really, there's nothing more important than what you put in your mouth every day.
A couple of things come to mind, and that is Hippocrates. You know, I know you know the father of modern medicine, beginning in the Greek era. We're echoing his thoughts here, and that is that let your food be your medicine, and your medicine be your food. If I walk into the doctor's office, and I'm going to pay him $200 to sit down with him and tell him about my ailments and, you know, my swollen lymph nodes and things of that nature. I mean, the problem is, you know, you're eating the wrong things, you're not exercising enough, malnourished diet, and depleted of the essential minerals and vitamins that should be in the soils. So much of this is not readily apparent. Much of it is beyond our control. Some of it is beyond our control. I'm not going back to that doctor. I'm going to go to the doctor who says, no, this isn't your fault. You know, this is, we have millions of people with the same problem. And here, you know, we're just going to put you on some chemotherapy. And that's going to just solve all your problems. In the meantime, your immune system is crushed, destroyed. And then when the invader does finally regain its strength, as does hopefully your body, your immune system is crushed, has no ability to fight. And that's why more than likely the longevity of most people who undergo these treatments rarely is beyond 5 years. We don't have to be afraid of this, but we have to take some responsibility. And once we do accept some responsibility, which I think the medical community is not willing to put on our shoulders, then you can formulate a plan of attack. Tell us more.
First, if you have a serious chronic issue of any kind, it could be cancer, it could be a metabolic disease, it could be an autoimmune disease, something, you know, Crohn's, diabetes, anything in those categories, you have the responsibility to start researching and understanding how you brought this upon yourself. And I know that sounds harsh, but it's absolutely true. Our bodies are amazing. They are fighting off billions, trillions of invaders every day, every second of the day, and that's what our bodies do. And so if we have a healthy baseline, that's how the body functions. When you become unhealthy, it means you're off of baseline, right? And so to me, the first thing to understand is that health isn't something we achieve. It's a place we exist in. Disease is a place we achieve. Unhealth is a place we accidentally get to. So all we want to do is return back to health. And so you're right. A lot of the frontline treatments, and I use that word loosely, in modern medicine either are masking the symptoms. Oh, you have an autoimmune disease. Here's your prednisone. Here's your constant steroid function, which is going to mask the symptoms for you. But it doesn't actually get at why you're having that autoimmune issue. Cancer. Oh, here, we're going to cut, burn, or poison you. These things, like, if you look at, if somebody said, Chris, I have a computer that was invented in 1940, I think you should look at it. It's awesome, state of the art. You're going to have to use this computer. You'd think I was nuts, right? But when you go for a modern dose of chemotherapy, whether it's cisplatin or something like that, those were invented in the 40s. It's like no progress. And so modern medicine does a lot of things really well. Listen, if I'm in a car accident, I have a heart attack, I'm going right there. But for other things, medicine is literally still stuck in the 30s and the 40s in some ways. It's one of the most regressive, least advanced areas of understanding that we have. And the thing is that if you know, part two of the story is, yeah, take responsibility, start reading. You can find dozens, if not hundreds, of anecdotes of people who have actually cured their cancer, right? And there's not one pill here, like, oh, go here to Mexico and eat this one diet, you know, do the Gerson diet. Your cancer is going to be unique. Each one behaves a little bit differently. There's a lot of evidence out there. But there are people out there who have been absolutely 100% in remission for many, many years, no detectable cancer, because they didn't go down the cut, burn, poison route. And if you look at the people who do go on modern frontline chemotherapy, not including these new fancy ones that are actually using the immune system, those are separate category, but I mean the old-time poisons, right, that just kill every cell that's dividing, kind of like a sledgehammer on an ant colony. If you look at those people who've gone through that chemo, in 10 years, how many of them are cancer-free? And the answer is like 3%. So if you said, hey, Chris, I've got this awesome stuff, it's frontline, you can go to a really fancy cancer center somewhere in the United States or Europe and fancy people and white doctors and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars, and it has a 97% failure rate, I hope that we would say, well, maybe that's not actually the best strategy out there. And so there are other strategies, but it begins with people understanding really what the basis of the disease is, why it took off, and the ways in which you can actually fight these things. And we're getting understanding. We know that some cancers need certain types of foods. They need a lot of glucose, or they need the presence of this factor, or they're really, really inhibited by having other things in there. We're learning all the time about, for instance, medical marijuana, in particular the cannabidiols or the so-called CBD part of that story, which is not the part that gets you high, right? That's the THC, but both THC and CBD interact with receptors in our bodies. We've got two types. They're everywhere, and a lot of cancers seem to have a really hard time living in the presence of these compounds. So that's an area that people could look to if they were interested in understanding that more. And again, we have data just is pouring in about the ways in which we can actively work with our bodies to support things. And I'll tell you what, medical science is one of the most regressive industries I know. It takes them forever to figure out something new or even to incorporate a new learning into their thinking. Here's a simple example. My daughter just had a pretty decent cut on the back of her hand, and we couldn't quite get it together ourselves, so we thought maybe it needed some stitches, and we go to the ER, and the nurse hands her some betadine and says, here, start washing that out. I was like, whoa, time out. We've known for 2 decades that betadine inhibits wound healing, and it's not modern therapy, even remotely close. Nobody uses betadine anymore, right, on an open wound like that. But they did, right? How did they not know that? So really, I think, you know, for anybody listening, for anybody who's got a health issue or is interested in being healthy, it begins with educating yourself, because the so-called experts, frustratingly, in our medical community, don't either have the time or the inclination to really be current in what we know works.
And I'd just like to throw a few statistics so that people can visualize numbers that we can toss into the back of our heads. We're inundated with information today, overwhelmed. Some of these excellent points you've raised. You poll these cancer doctors, these oncologists, on their willingness to put themselves and their families through the same battery of, as you, I think, aptly note, you know, cut, poison, and burn. And of course, we're referring to surgery, which I don't have a huge problem with in some cases, if it be a small nodule or something, or melanoma. So surgery may be in some cases, but the poison process, we're referring to chemo, doctors referring to chemo here, and he's referring to burn as radiation. Fewer than 80% in one study, and fewer than 90% would put themselves or their families. And the statistics you brought up, just say less than 3% really benefit. And there is some interesting peer-reviewed articles, if you want to take the time to, you know, in the literature, that show that really that's an overestimation, that it's closer to 0 to 0.5% of these treatments have helped anyone in the long term. And in general, I'll never forget listening to one brilliant oncologist who was in the field for almost 50 years. And he's on record here. You can find him online. And he said, you know, the best treatment for cancer is to live as far away from a cancer treatment facility as possible. This is a retired oncologist. I don't want people to think we're just harping on this because we're not anti-medicine. If you're in a car wreck, you know, there is no better place to be probably than some emergency room. Okay, they're gonna fix you up. That's what they do best, trauma. But when it comes to chronic disease, I mean, I'd rather go to a leech therapist or a bloodletting. Well, maybe we've covered this. Is there anything I've left out? I'm sure there's some topicality here that you'd like to wrap up this discussion with.
Well, this is just an increasing area of interest for me, and part of the work that I've done in the world is put the economy, energy, environment into a story. I'm starting to assemble a story around this, and it begins with my own life. You know, my own transformation of my own health really began with some of these things we're talking about. It began with really beginning to control what I'm putting in my body, and it's ended with this idea. When I walk into a supermarket now, right, this is where all the food is, and you walk in and it's just 20 aisles of, you know, consumer bliss. I got to tell you, when I walk in those stores now, literally the whole middle of the store doesn't have anything in it I can eat, like the whole middle. I have to walk around the edge. You know, there's like very little that's actually food out there that's worth eating at this point. And so it's getting increasingly difficult to really eat well. You have to put some effort into it. And it really begins with eating organic as much as you can for a variety of reasons, and mostly because of the Roundup used. And it begins with finding local sources of food and maybe even growing some of your own, all things that I've done.
Folks who, you know, don't have the time to digest all of this or are curious, functional medicine. I mean, Dr. Martinson here and myself were both interested in functional medicine. I think one of the founders in this area is Dr. Mark Hyman. Can't recommend enough his work. He I think, is just one of these living treasure troves of information. And just as the saying goes, physician, heal thyself, this is exactly what Dr. Mark Hyman did, and he documents it so well online in these quick little 5 to 7 minute, for those of us who just don't have the time, we're overwhelmed all the time from morning, you know, to night, type in Dr. Mark Hyman at YouTube and he will blow you away. And he walks through the supermarket, just as Dr. Martinson pointed out here, until he gets to the produce section. And he gives some very real ideas, recipes and whatnot on what we have to do and change our mindset. And I agree with you. Roundup, I think, is just the tip of the iceberg. And you and I, we've talked about this in the past, that what they've found is that what's happened to our food supply is that during the Civil War and over hundreds of years of large scale growing, the ground, the resources there, not only is it depleted, but it's filled with arsenic, cyanide, and lead. And much of this came from these just early pesticides. And unfortunately, as you've pointed out, and so many others, Dr. Oz and others, and Dr. Hyman, when the soil's depleted, the plants search around for whatever they can find to make up for that, just like our bodies, incidentally. And they reach out to these nasty chemicals that we've put there, and they start to concentrate. And when they do, you know, it might take a pound of grain to make your loaf of bread, okay? And you've got concentrated heavy metals and nasty metals throughout. And guess what? Those same grains end up in the livestock. So the meat is the most dangerous place. That's where it accumulates at the highest levels because the feed is toxic. And I can verify this. Even our organic feed that we've tested here at my home had dangerously high levels of cyanide, which is the precursor to diabetes, the precursor to lymphoma, the precursor to almost every nasty disease, including fibromyalgia, and so many others of these chronic diseases. So I just hope folks will wrap their minds around what Dr. Martinson's brought up and check out Dr. Mark Hyman, Functional Medicine. You don't have to be afraid of these diseases if you really start to get the right information. Let's move on to topicality, Doctor, that folks are excited about and that our listeners are precious metals aficionados and they like the commodities sector. And I know you're watching oil, crude oil, and West Texas Intermediate crude closely.
Well, I am, and the summary of the commodity space at this point in time, it's signaling something that I think our stock market has not quite digested yet, to use that word again, is that we're in a massive global slowdown economically right now. This isn't a big surprise. One of the theories that we've been working with at Peak Prosperity a long time is goes by the name First the Fall. We think there's a big deflationary event coming. It's going to just sweep through a world awash in debt. It's going to be very, very damaging. It's going to hurt a bunch of people, economies, nation states. It could lead to conflict. It's going to be a fairly pronounced period of deflation. And by deflation, I don't mean, you know, the price of the car went down next week. Deflation is a monetary event. It means that not enough money and credit is being accumulated in the system or created in the system to support all the prior debts that have been accumulated in the system. And when deflations get started, they tend to feed on themselves. It means I can't pay you because, you know, my business has gone down. I have too much debt. I can't service my debt, so I can't pay you, and then you can't service your debt. And then, you know, on and on, and the daisy chain goes until all the excess debt is wiped out. And unfortunately, there's maybe $100 trillion of too much debt in the world. There's $200 trillion total. I think it needs to go away by about half. So first the fall, first this deflation comes, this really scares the central banks, and then they panic out, and this time they give money to Main Street, not Wall Street, and then we have the second part of this story, which is a very, very large inflationary event. So to your listeners, you know, this is going to take some patience, but here's the strategy for getting through this. What I'm saying is that paper claims, whether it's a stock, a bond, a derivative, even currency itself, those are going to essentially be proven to be worth the paper they're printed on or maybe less. And what's going to shine over the long term, of course, is real hard assets, tangible things, land, productive land in particular, timberland, farmland, good high-quality real estate, gold, silver, oil. These are the true forms of actual wealth. We've forgotten that for a little while as a country, maybe even as a species. that's what's coming back again. But first, we're going to go through a fairly significant financial panic where if we're measuring the price of things in dollars, it's going to be very difficult to sort of predict what's going to go where and why. But if we just forget about the dollars as the measuring stick for a minute, you know, the things I'm tracking more carefully now is the ratio of things that are real things to real things. You know, how many grams of gold per barrel of oil, how many barrels of oil per, you know, solid commercial real estate property, how many ounces of gold for an acre of land, things like that. Because the measuring stick, the currency itself, increasingly unreliable. I'm of the opinion, and our site is all dedicated to this idea that we just have way too many paper claims and not enough real production, and history is clear. All we have to answer at this point is who is going to eat the losses. And the bankers are being very diligent in making sure it's taxpayers, and you know, you're watching the fine people of Greece get absolutely crushed by the bankers laying the pain of their bad lending decisions on the people of Greece. People of Greece are starting to figure it out. They got there a little late. They really should have taken things into their own hands a number of years ago. But this is where we are in the story. I wish we weren't here, but, you know, we have just entirely too much debt in the system, and that's just on the economic side of the story. So, yes, commodities are going to be a great place to be, but first we're looking for a lot more weakness.
Let's look at some of the statistics that some of the top pundits have brought up recently. You know, hat tip to Martin Armstrong, the forecaster, if you will, interesting documentary. He'll be on the show in a couple of weeks. He points out that there has never been an even one example of negative interest rates in over 5,000 years. We start talking about the anomalies that are popping up, which should, I think, be raising some red flags around the world with our policymakers and institutions, not to mention individual investors. There's one interesting anomaly, but here's another one. We had Dr. Paul Craig Roberts on the show I'd never even thought about, but it's obvious if you do. We all know there's about $250 trillion in interest rate-sensitive notional derivatives sitting on our domestic balance sheets here at our five or six top money center lending banks. Okay, so in other words, long story short, the banks have a huge debt problem. But if you look at the world GDP, which is roughly $76 trillion on an annual basis, everything produced by everybody on the globe, any one of those five or six banks has more than that much debt. If you can wrap your mind around that, I challenge the listeners to. And that, of course, is just a train wreck waiting to happen.
Well, it is. And, you know, the whole idea behind derivatives is that they're supposed to be these wonderful insurance policies, and on paper they are. You know, it says, oh, if the interest rate of this country spikes or collapses, I'm covered. You know, and therefore, because I'm covered, I don't have to carry any risk on my book. I don't have to set any assets aside. I don't have any margin I have to put there. I don't need any capital. I'm covered, right? Well, what we know about derivatives is they seem to be insurance policies that work until you need them. And then nobody wants to test them and find out if they can work, because of course they can't. And that's why the banking industry, we call this the Citi Amendment, worked very hard in a funding bill in December 2014, inserted what's called the Citi Amendment, which makes derivative claims between banks superior to depositor claims, meaning that if you have money at a big money center bank and they lose $1 trillion on bad derivative bets, that you the deposit holder are a source of funds to help make that bet whole. And the frustrating part about this is, of course, you know, the A, that it happened, but B, derivatives are a zero sum game. So if Citi loses $1 trillion to JP Morgan, JP gets the trillion. Citi loses $1 trillion. Oops, we're going to have to go into the depositor funds at Citi to make up that shortfall, right? That's the frustrating part, because it's really a heads we win, tails you lose moment for the banks. That's what they've been doing, and it's one of the reasons, one of the many reasons, I am increasingly counseling people to just have as little to do with the banks as possible. If you have money in a bank, don't have it in one with a lot of derivatives on the books. You go to the Office of the Comptroller Currency, it's OCC.gov. They have a quarterly report on derivatives. You can pull it up. It's a PDF. You go to a table about two-thirds of the way down, and it shows you the top 25 banks with the derivative exposure. Don't bank with them. That's been my rule.
First of all, I think it's great advice. Encourage everyone to do exactly as the doctors said. But I would just throw one proviso in here. What if they've devised even more sneaky ways, nefarious ways to inundate the system with this toxic debt? Because, you know, if you read Frank Portnoy's fiasco and so many other great reads since then, I mean, that was their number one job at his financial institution, was convincing gullible folks who needed to either make up a certain amount of money or were just desperate to have a higher return, promising the moon, and then before you know it just blows up their balance sheet. And this happened all over the West Coast, and it's happened all over the world since then. And not to mention, there's always the local banker, which more than likely has next to none or next to zero toxic debt on its balance sheet. So there are some alternatives there, and nothing beats hard assets, I guess, as far as liquidity goes. And maybe that's a good segue into wrapping things up here today. Our current game plan here for 2016 includes a surprising number of increases, or at least an extent to which the Fed will raise rates. Most of my guests just disagree with us. They're convinced that rates stay at zero or negative forever. But I'm sorry, the numbers are screaming for at least 100 basis points before the end of 2016. So under that scenario, we're concerned that commodities will experience continued pressure likely for the next 12 to 18 months, which should set the stage for, of course, a dollar rally. But then comes the recovery. Does this fit at all with your current thesis?
It does. But in recovery, the way we're looking at it is the recovery is going to mean a lot of money gets scared at sitting in giant, giant pools, and it decides it doesn't want to be in this fraudulent paper world anymore. Where does it go? It's going to try and squeeze through some very narrow commodity doorways. And this has happened over and over again in history. People become fascinated with things, and they want tangible assets, and then they become fascinated with paper, and the pendulum ticks and tocks back and forth. So we think we're at the apex of the swing of the fascination with paper, and we're about to just sweep back towards things. And, of course, that will be aided by a little bit of rocket fuel from the Fed doing stuff with monetary policy. So that's the world we're in. We think, you know, you have to be positioned now for these swings. They're going to be violent. They're going to be disruptive. Who knows where they go? That's why Adam Taggart and I wrote this, our most recent book. It just got released a couple days ago. It's called Prosper. And it really helps guide people, not just in the financial sphere, but that financial capital is important, but it's just one form of capital. You and I were discussing a second form of capital, which is our living health. We have eight forms of capital that we think people should be truly diversified across all of those, and it includes things like social capital, the depth and trust built into your social network, very important determinant of both your current happiness and possibly your future survival. So we talk about all of these things because we think, you know, I got to be honest, we're coming into a time where analysis isn't going to help. Nobody can predict what's going to come next. We've never been here with negative interest rates. We've never been here with monetary policy. The world seems as about tense with each other as we have since 1911. There's just a lot of things out there that say, hey, probably a bad strategy to assume that everything's just going to recover and go back to how it was. We don't think that's very likely, but it's possible. But even if it does, some things that we would recommend people do make sense no matter which future comes. But if you're really diversified across all eight forms of capital, then you will be very thankful that you were should a number of future scenarios arrive.
Firstly, that sounds like must read. Prosper, the name of the book. We'll certainly have links up for our listeners and give you a good media blast. I'd love to see a copy of that. But I'd like to keep with a couple of important notes you've brought up. We have so many guests here on the show, so I'm privileged to hear the inner thoughts on air and both off air sometimes, the inner thinking of some of these fine financial minds, and it's quite a diverse background of folks. And notice a disturbing, not disturbing, but a common theme that seems to run there, keeping in line with your comments, the ancient Chinese might have put it, I mean, may you never live in interesting times, or may you live in interesting times as a curse. And I'm afraid this really is interesting because it's really a dichotomy. On the one hand, you are right. Negative interest rates, no way. Total monetization of global debt around the world. Show me when that happened. But then on the other side of the spectrum, we're facing a dilemma where things are remarkably similar, and that is excessive profligate money spending and printing like mad, what led up to the French Revolution, commonalities there, plus you threw in there the deflation, the D word. Seem to remember that well in 2008 as well as 1929. through the 1930s. It's almost a worst world scenario, but what I'd really like for people to get their minds around is your idea of switching from paper to sound assets. A couple neat little stats I want everyone to remember. There has never really been a time that we can find here, and I have to thank Cliff Asness and Dr. Fama, University of Chicago, for these numbers. Cliff Asness, if you want to invest right, read his stuff, that there has never been a time where you saw the price to earnings on the CAPE ratio, okay, is something like 25, and historically it's 15, 16, 17. So we're way out there in valuations, if you want to use valuation metrics. But then we're way off the charts in bond land, too. What I suspect is all these buybacks by corporations, which has been, I think, the rocket fuel underneath this market, is starting to dry up because the debt is now becoming a burden and it's harder to borrow. So you add that into the mix and you could, and keep in mind, these 80th percentile on both stocks and bonds, you can go to 95th percentile or you can go to 100. We're entering just a time where valuations are so extended, and this is the crux of it, with bonds and equities. That has, according to their work, never happened before. And I'm just, again, I return to your concept. We need to be thinking about switching from overvalued paper assets and thinking more about the return of our money and not on our money in sound hard assets.
That's exactly where our thinking is. And by the way, you know, an expensive CAPE ratio makes sense if and only if you have a real solid, compelling story for future growth. We don't have one. We don't have another internet. There's no technology coming along that we can point to. The only thing fueling this so-called growth has been deficit spending, monetary printing, corporate buybacks. It's paper games. So the first thing anybody who's buying super expensive financial assets, be those stocks or bonds, needs to ask is, where's the future growth going to come from? We are 10 years into subpar economic growth for the world. My work on resources explains why that's not just a temporary 10-year hiccup, but a rather permanent condition. Our stock market and bond markets are priced as if not only is that not true, but we're about to return to explosive growth. So it's really on the bulls to answer this question. Where's that growth going to come from? What's the driver? Let me know, because I'm searching for it.
I think it's such an important question. As we pointed out, look, valuations are extended. Then what's going to move us beyond it? Well, they can't buy many more of their shares back. They don't have the funds to do that. Bonds are pricey. You're going to earn 1% on your money for how long, you know, or less, a negative rate. Savings accounts, there's a lot of talk about switching into negative territory there. You know, so we'll hold your money for a price. I'll give you my money and I'll pay you for the privilege. We're entering a time where what will be the driver of these earnings, the engine of growth in not only the economy, but the corporate engine, you know, where does that come from? And of course, yes, there can always be another internet or, but I would also point out that Moore's Law has really come, which is hard for me to believe, to a screeching halt in recent years. And I wonder if history won't look back on this time, say, you know, well, they hit that brick wall with silicon and it really took 5 or 10 years until they developed DNA computing and things of that nature, which is photon computing and whatnot. But I mean, until they reach that level, you know, Moore's Law couldn't continue. And much of our growth has been based on increases in productivity due to technology. Dr. Chris Martinson, what you want to get for this holiday for everybody? Well, here is his magnum opus, Prosper. Tell us a bit more and any other contact information, please.
I'd be happy to. So Prosper, the subtitle is How to Prepare for the Future and Create a World Worth Inheriting. We're at a period of time where all you have to do is just crack a newspaper and you can read about disappearing frogs, soil being destroyed, aquifers going away, geopolitical tensions, oil is getting harder and harder to find. We're going from 7 to 9 billion people. China's buying resources all over the world. What's going on? Prosper is the companion to the Crash Course, which explains why this is all happening. We've got some context for it. We're not surprised by the low growth at all. This is actually well within our prediction set. So that's the problem definition in the Crash Course. Prosper's the solution set. It says, look, given all of that, how are we going to respond? How do we want to be? This is not about being afraid. It's not about thinking you're going to survive when everybody else dies. This is actually about how to be engaged and resilient, how to really bring things into your life that are going to help you today and be potentially lifesavers tomorrow. And so we're very pleased with this book. It represents 6 years of giving seminars and gathering data off our websites and finding out what works and what doesn't work. And so it really is a great gift. You know, people who've read it have said, listen, I'm giving this to people I know who aren't on board yet, because this is just so well framed and it's just so lovingly put together and it's just really speaking to people where they really are. It's not trying to convince them the world's ending or any of that stuff.
Don't we have enough doom and gloom in our ears already and fear-mongering? What we need are tangible, empirical, real, down-to-earth solutions to problems that we're facing today. I mean, look at the numbers. I mean, to listen to Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, he just didn't sound like a former government official with this amazing CV and track record and all of these accolades and awards. He really just drove home the dilemma, the disaster that the middle class is facing today, and not just in America, but in the Western world. That's why I think, you know, Prosper and this type of thinking, this type of movement is so important, because we need tangible solutions. We don't need theory. We don't need hyperbole. We don't need theoretical constructs. We need something tangible that we can hold in our hand and work through this mess we're partially responsible for, but we've also inherited. What a great discussion. We're going to look forward to having you back on the show, sir.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, my featured guest today, Dr. Stephen Leeb, 25 years plus of investment experience, and is the author of many books, including The Oil Factor, Coming Economic Collapse, Game Over, and his latest Red Alert. Welcome back, Dr. Leeb.
Thank you so much, Chris. Always a pleasure talking to you.
Well, it's great to have you back with us. And, you know, I thought we could start off today with a lot of the drama we're seeing in the markets. Volatility has increased by, let's just use a couple metrics here, the VIX and the VVIX metrics at the CBOE. We're starting to see the risk premium come back into the market, the risk changing here, the factors around these markets. Have you been watching this? And if so, tell us what you see, please.
I basically see, yes, I agree with you. I mean, there's no doubt that markets have become much more risky. I mean, risk metrics have increased sharply in the market. But at the same time, the market is bound by trading ranges, I guess, around 1850 on the downside in the S&P and about 2150 on the upside. And within that range, there's just tremendous volatility. And it's not really just confined to the stock market. It's also in the oil pits. Oil some goes up and down in a week. I would say total change in a week can be like 10%, 2% a day sometimes. It's a reflection that investors, whomever they may be, retail or institutional, really don't have an idea of what's happening. And this is not just, you know, your typical investor, your typical hedge fund who, you know, studies this stuff all day long, et cetera. This is also applies to the central banks. They don't know what's going on. And it makes for a very, very volatile market. The Fed, you know, came out with a statement today, which still says that they're not really sure what they should do in December. And, you know, if the Fed has no idea whether they should raise interest rates in December or not, and they're going to look at another employment report to find out what the answer should be, I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, you know, these employment numbers are very, I would say, soft numbers in the sense that they'll be adjusted dramatically going forward. You know, the anomalies that you see in today's economy are unlike any that any of us have seen. So I'm not, you know, these comments I'm making about the Fed are not meant to be harsh comments. You know, just to give you one example, you have unemployment insurance claims about as low as they've ever been. I mean, as low as they've been in 50 years. And that's a measure of how many people are being laid off. Very, very few people are being laid off. In order to go back, in order to find a comparable period, you have to really go back to the 60s. In the 60s, that was before women started working, you know, in droves. What you have today is, you know, post-female entry into the labor force. These are numbers that have no explanation. I mean, other than saying that a lot of people are dropping out of the labor force, you know, there's no wage pressure. There's no, you know, no one's willing to pay higher wages. And economic growth relative to the number of people that are not getting laid off, relative to unemployment insurance claims, has never been as low as it is today. I mean, this economy should be growing at about a 4% rate with unemployment insurance claims under, let's say, 290,000. Instead, it's growing less than 2%. There are dots here that really cannot be connected. There are anomalies out there that are really extraordinary. All of a sudden, you know, you see oil production sliding a little bit in this country. I'm giving you another anomaly that's from a completely different source. Oil production starts declining a little bit in this country, and yet oil inventories go through the roof. How do you explain that? I mean, I can offer an explanation for all of these things, but they're things that we have never seen before. I mean, in the oil, the instance with the oil would be that fracking itself was using a tremendous amount of energy. And when the number of wells, the number of rigs fell sharply, so did the amount of energy that was going into that industry. And therefore, you see this huge buildup in oil inventories. Now, that's the only explanation I can find. I mean, maybe somebody else has another one that's more sensible, but to me, that's the only one that makes any kind of sense. Suggests that the whole idea of fracking was wrong to begin with, because, you know, if you're going to produce energy, you better make sure you're getting more energy than the energy that you're using. In other words, if you're using 10 barrels of energy and all you're getting is 9 barrels of energy out of that 10 barrels, that's a net negative. And, you know, the statistics that we're seeing, you know, almost suggest that is what's happening. You know, so it goes. And, you know, can you really blame investors for being, you know, skittish and not knowing? Can you blame the Fed for being skittish and not knowing what to do? If the Fed raises interest rates in December or whenever they do, they're going to be raising them against the background of a very strong dollar. Well, a strong dollar lowers inflation. A strong dollar also hurts our manufacturing sector. That's basic economics. That hasn't changed. And that's exactly what the Fed doesn't want to do. It goes, I mean, Stanley Fisher, you know, had a piece, I think it was last night I read it, and he went on and on about the dollar and what the dollar, you know, strength was doing to the economy. Yet he still may vote for a Fed increase in December because, you know, you're at 5% unemployment. But, you know, are you really? You know, when you look at the participation rates, I guess what I'm saying is that we're sort of, you know, people talk about singularities. Well, this is a singular time in economic history. And the uncertainty associated with it is just phenomenal. And it's not just stocks. It applies to commodities and everything else. Now, I think one reason, obviously, is China. And China is very important, and we have no idea really what's going on in China. But we do know it's very big and very, very important. And by some measures, it's bigger than us. And, you know, one news item that sort of got pushed to the back pages because of the horrific tragedy that occurred in Paris was the IMF's ruling or the IMF's decision, not the board of the IMF, but the technical people in the IMF said that the Chinese yuan met all their conditions. Christine Lagarde, always mispronounce her name, said that unequivocally the yuan satisfied every condition the IMF needs in order to approve it for admission into the SDR. What is this going to mean? No one really has any ideas. If you go to the internet, you'll see it means nothing. It's a game changer. I happen to believe it probably won't be immediately a game changer, but it will lead to a game changer. Immediately, it may suggest to people that the dollar is not the only game in town anymore. There's a yuan now, which will probably have the second highest weighting in the SDR. And it's clearly a challenge to the dollar. But what does that mean? I don't think anyone knows. Why don't they know? Because we've never had experience with a country being so big and having an economy that, let's say, measured by purchasing power parity, is larger than the U.S. We've never had that kind of situation before. We've never had a situation with ISIS. I mean, all of a sudden, ISIS is in Libya. They're in, you know, Africa. They're in Paris. These are the kinds of uncertainties that are, one of them would be enough to create uncertainty. But when you put them all together, well, here's another one. I just can't resist. I'm sorry. But you look at oil down to $40 a barrel. And this is with oil production, and this I'm pretty sure of, oil production right now is running at, I would say, at least 100% of capacity. In other words, it may actually be more than 100% of capacity, because you may have countries like Saudi Arabia actually producing more than they should, than they can sustain. And yet, oil prices are down to 40. Well, anytime you have something producing at 100% capacity, demand increasing, and it is increasing for oil, not greatly, but it's still increasing, oil prices should not be at 40. They should be at levels that will ration oil, not levels that will encourage consumption. Yet here we are with oil sitting around $40 and capacity and production around 100%. These are anomalies that I just don't think we've seen, in any of our lifetimes. I mean, maybe during the Depression you had comparable anomalies, but this is a weird time. I mean, I hate to, use a word like weird, but it is weird. It's strange. It's unknown. And I think until it clarifies itself, I think you're going to continue to see a tremendous amount of volatility. I happen to believe that has to be a consequence of the Chinese, let's say if the IMF does approve that China yuan does go into the SDR basket. Almost surely, I think gold goes up, the dollar will go down. I'm not saying a lot. I'm just saying, to a certain extent, gold will go up, and to a certain extent, dollar will go down. And that might clarify things at least a little bit. That might give the Fed a little bit more reason to, give them a little bit more breathing room in terms of what they do, et cetera, and may make it a little bit clearer for investors in terms of dealing with China. But, then the questions will come, well, are the Chinese going to argue that the SDR should become the reserve currency and it should be backed by gold? I think they will eventually, but until people, until that becomes a real discussion point, I think you might have a breathing period, maybe a year and a half of normal market behavior. And, that could be okay. I mean, the economy may grow and, market could turn out to be all right. But I'm just saying, I have never in my lifetime seen, the kinds of anomalies. And I keep coming back to the word anomalies because I think they're very important in studying things that you're seeing today. And I've gone on and on.
It's a wonderful overview. And I think what you've done here so aptly is set the stage for interesting discussions. So let's talk about some of these anomalies, because you're right. Beginning with maybe in my background, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, how Sherlock just loved to look for those little things out of place. It's kind of a euphemism for an anomaly. And you're right. It was a black swan flock of anomalies.
You're right. Black swans are no longer enough. You need something else than you've never seen before, because black swans you do see occasionally. You need something that is like, that would represent a true mutation that we've never seen before in order to explain all these things happening together.
I think it's well said. So let's break it down then into maybe more simple components, some correlations. And you talk about the crude oil market. That's a major interest to many of our listeners. One interesting aspect of this sector that we've noted in the past is the high correlation with the U.S. dollar. Now, U.S. dollar, of course, benefiting from weakness in the yen currency, as well as the eurozone. Okay, they're keeping their rates at zero, now going into negative territory, first time in, 5,000 years of recorded history?
There you go. That's an anomaly.
And, of course, hat tip to Martin Armstrong for bringing that up, 5,000 years of recorded history. We have so much going on here, and the correlations are startling. So we have a strong dollar. It hurts our West Texas Intermediate crude tremendously. I think you'd probably agree it might be setting the stage at some point for a long-term opportunity. Any thoughts?
My feeling is that when oil turns, it'll be, dramatic. It'll be kind of breathtaking. And if I were predicting, I'd say 18 months from now, you'll have three-digit oil, and it might be, it might be 150. You might have record levels of oil prices because you're going to see a lot that changes. I mean, some of this stuff in the background, Chris, you have things like this happening, which are not making headlines. China, for instance, in Shanghai, has set up another benchmark for oil. And obviously, they want Mideast oil. They want to secure their supply of Mideast oil. And one of the stories I saw, I don't know, about 2 or 3 weeks ago, is that Saudi Arabia and Kuwait are competing with each other to sell China as much oil as they possibly can at these very, very low prices. Now, why should Saudi Arabia be doing this? I mean, if you look, here's an anomaly. I mean, if you look at Saudi Arabia, their all-in cost for a barrel of oil, probably $100. Now, obviously, it might only cost them $5 to drill for that oil. But what it costs them to maintain a social structure within the economy so that the society doesn't blow apart within their societies, what it costs them in terms of defense. I mean, they've got to defend that country against ISIS, Yemen, Iran. I mean, you know, it costs a tremendous amount of money. And when you add up all those costs, it's about $100 per barrel of oil. And that's why the Saudis have been draining their reserves, called back the money from their sovereign wealth fund, or, you know, they had farmed out some money to other sovereign managers, and they've taken that money back, issued a lot of debt. The reason they're doing it is that they cannot function indefinitely with oil at $40 or $45 a barrel. Yet they're in a race with, they had been in a race with Kuwait to give China as much oil as they possibly could deliver. This is hard to explain. It really is. Unless, you know, and I'm just giving one possible explanation. There may be much better ones around. But what I see is if China is trying to set up a new benchmark for oil, and they're trading in that benchmark. I mean, if they're not now, they will be. I mean, they were supposed to have started in October, and, you know, maybe it'll be early January, but definitely they're going to do it. That new benchmark may be the benchmark for oil, because there's certainly not a lot of Brent oil around. There is West Texas oil, but that's not nearly as much as oil as you find in the Mideast. So if they have a benchmark that defines more oil than you find anywhere else, that is going to be the benchmark. And it is going to be a case for, you know, marking oil in terms of yuan. Anytime you start a new benchmark, you want to be part of that benchmark, because when people buy a piece of paper representing a call on that benchmark, they're representing, it represents a call on the oil you're producing. And I think one reason Kuwait and Saudi Arabia want to get as much of their oil into China is they want their oil to be the largest percentage of that benchmark that China is establishing as possible. What are the consequences for us here? Well, not good. I mean, one reason the dollar has, you know, had such a glorious run, not just now, but, you know, has been so important to this economy for the last, I don't know, 40 years, has been because of oil. Commodities and oil in particular are defined and valued in terms of dollars. But now, if the most liquid benchmark in the world, or the most important benchmark in the world, is traded in yuan, that also is a major shift, and it adds to the uncertainty. I wouldn't necessarily call that an anomaly per se, but it certainly adds to the uncertainty that exists in today's world. And it's, you know, one of these factors that is almost in the corner. No one's focusing on it. No one's focusing on another, you know, factoid I'll give you, is that all of a sudden China has started issuing gold coins in grams. That's never happened. They've never issued gold coins in grams before. They've always issued them in ounces. Why? Because gold is traded in ounces. But China is sort of making it clear that they want their unit of measure to define what gold is and how gold is traded. And they also have a gold exchange. No one knows how much gold China has. And that's another case for uncertainty in today's world. So, you know, you started out by asking me all the uncertainty, and I'm really agreeing with you. A lot of this stuff is anomalous. It's still anomalous in the sense that no one has seen what's going on today. No country, at least since World War II, and maybe before World War II, has really been sort of a match for the United States in terms of its economy. Militarily, China is not yet a match for the U.S., but they're probably catching up. And, you know, this creates a new kind of economics. It creates a new sort of dynamic. I mean, all the economic textbooks have been written under the assumption that the U.S. is the major economy in the world. You know, the old expression, when the U.S. sneezes, the world gets a pneumonia. Well, that's no longer true. It's now China is right up there with us, and maybe in some sense even more important in certain ways. I mean, I still think this is the greatest economy and the greatest country ever. And the anger that exists in this country. You want an anomaly? Here's another anomaly. Who would have believed 6 months ago that the leader in the Republican nomination, race for the Republican nomination, now admittedly it's still early, would be Donald Trump with 31%. He's like 9 points ahead of the number two guy, who was a pediatric surgeon. The establishment guys all are in, you know, close to single digits. That's an anomaly. That's a major anomaly.
I'd really like to stick, though, with your overview and analysis of China, because we really have to embrace the cultural differences that can be of benefit to us here in our society. And instead of feeling so repelled by things that don't fit our societal norms, and we've discussed this ad infinitum here on the show, and I don't mind repeating that we both at least see eye to eye that there's so much to learn, so much to benefit from their culture and their economic success, and really, which mirrors our early success 100, 150 years ago.
Totally agree.
Given the statistics that you've started to bring up, A, the yuan now is being a proposed reserve currency at the IMF. This is being taken seriously.
More than seriously. It's you know, would be an extraordinary if the IMF did not approve it. When you have the head of the IMF saying, almost in so many words, that it clearly satisfies every single criteria that we have to be included as a reserve currency. Hard to go against that. Gold being denominated in grand.
Exactly. And I would just point directly to at least a parallel here with the United States. And for so many decades, you might say over 100 years, we had so much silver in our circulation up until just recently. You could easily grab a dime or a quarter and find a pre-65 silver, 90% or 40% silver. In an indirect way, they are positioning themselves, the People's Bank of China and other policymakers, positioning their people. Their policymakers and officials seem to care about their people.
This is true, and it's hard to believe, but this is one reason that attracted me to China, you know, to why I decided to write about China and started studying it. No, they're not a democracy, but they're not a democracy almost by choice. I mean, if they thought a democratic society would be the best for them right now, they would become a democratic society. I mean, they're a meritocratic society. And you know, I'm not saying that there isn't corruption. There's a ton of corruption. There's a ton of corruption in this country. But by and large, China is a meritocracy. The president of China right now, I mean, before he got this job as running the whole show, he probably was head of a province of 100 million people. Like, you know, he just didn't, you know, win an election. He had to prove that he could govern.
There's other anomalies as we're sticking with that theme here. For instance, in China, earlier in the program I'm in here, you know, we learned that they require to have a seasoned veteran on every board of directors, on every corporation. And the idea there is pretty simple. I mean, it might sound a little bit paternalistic. There is perspective that is gained.
Absolutely. They're long-term thinkers. I copied an article from Bloomberg last night where Chinese mothers have started, you know, a grouping. I'm not sure exactly how it's working, where they're teaching their six-year-olds. This is not the government. This is the mothers, okay, of kids in China. They are teaching their six-year-olds how to do coding on a computer, how to code. We don't think that way in this country. I mean, we've got to take a longer-term perspective on things. I mean, we're capable of it. There was a time when this country was just great.
No, we just taught our two-year-old to say, ni hao. It's becoming like a knee-jerk reaction as he tries to pick up a little Mandarin.
That's great. Yes.
But that's going to take more than that, and you're right. I mean, it's going to require to remain competitive. Where you really stand out in today's world, in today's job market, comes down to something that's near and dear to you as well, and that's mathematics. Mathematics will be, I think, the only way to compete for most, not all. I mean, there's always going to be lawyers and doctors and whatnot. But that market share is going to, I think, to dwindle more and more as expert systems start to take over more.
Chris, you're taking words right out of my mouth. You really are. This is what I told, you know, my son, and you know, he's a little older than your son. So I'm sure I'm a lot older than you. But he's, you know, studying mathematics. And I said, this is great because, you know, you'll be welcomed in China if you know mathematics. It's very, very important. It's kind of a universal language. And, you know, you took words right out of my mouth. I could not have said it better. In fact, I would not have said it as well as you just did. And it's not something that we can't do here. And it's something that we were doing here. I mean, when we had these private-public partnerships like Bell Labs. Bell Labs was a private company, was part of a private company, AT&T, but it was sort of like, you know, what they could charge was fixed by the government, but it was still, you know, a stock people could buy, get good income on, et cetera, grew, et cetera. And they had Bell Laboratories, and I think that was the greatest research institute ever, ever. You know, out of that, you know, came the transistor, came the laser, came the internet. I'm not making this up. I mean, virtually everything that we see today on our desk is basically a derivative.
I think very few people have studied the work of Paul Dirac, okay? And he's such an interesting character because he was highly autistic. And I think few people...
Yes, yes, a lot of them are, yes.
...are out on the spectrum, you know, functional autistics, a lot of Asperger's in this area. Their work, and particularly the quantum level, which Einstein poo-pooed, you know, to such a great degree, and it is so imperfect, but that work led to the great breakthroughs at Bell Labs, as you referred to, and then Bell Labs, as you know, morphed into Silicon Valley that we see today.
Well, it did to some extent, but it also, you know, there is no center of gravity when it comes to, you know, major research breakthroughs in this country anymore. There isn't China, incidentally. I mean, you know, for cybersecurity, they have a center dedicated to cyber innovation. Even in chess, I mean, China, this is unbelievable. I mean, I happen to like chess. I'm not very good at it, but I love it. All of a sudden, in the course of a decade, China has gone from nowhere in chess to having the best team in the world.
Well, tell us your story of Garry Kasparov. You mentioned that you met him.
Spent an hour and a half or 2 hours with him. Yes, I didn't. But yeah, I send him my stuff and I'll run into him again. I was supposed to have lunch with him back, but I didn't. No, I did. I have spent a couple of hours with him, and I know someone who knows him who worked with him very closely in Russia. So yeah, I know Garry, and I know people who know Garry very well. Yes. So I can say that, yes.
My first passion was chess, and I used to play with Eastern European immigrants because one of my friend's fathers was a big engineer in the Atlanta, greater Atlanta area, and he helped really create the first modem at Hayes Computer. You might remember it was a small company.
Well, I do remember Hayes Computer,
back in the days of the 14-4 at Bauds. It was a cutting edge at the time. And so they would bring in other folks from Hungary to try to help them escape. I had this opportunity to play with people twice my age, but you learn a lot of interesting information from people like that. So that's where the interest grew for Go. And this is, we shouldn't be covering this now, but Go, I think, is chess on steroids. If you love chess, Doctor, I think you would really embrace Go.
I'm going to start reading about Go. I mean, you know, maybe it's a new trick I should try. An old dog like me should try and learn. I mean, I'm very intrigued by it. And, you know, the computers have much, much greater problems with Go than they do with chess. They have problems with chess, incidentally, because human intuition just is ahead of them, but ahead of the computers. But with Go, they have persistent problems because it's just, you know, it sort of demonstrates the difference between, you know, human intuition and what you can do with a computer. And computers cannot keep up with human intuition. They just can't. And that's one reason I would be very intrigued, and I may learn about Go.
It's always a pleasure hearing your thoughts. Dr. Lieb, please tell us more about the services you provide and any other contact information you'd like to leave.
Anybody that wants to know everything about me, they can either go to Wikipedia or they can go to Lieb.com. And you'll know more than you want to know about me.
Well, you're too humble, but we'll certainly put up links, and I'd like to encourage everyone to direct your web browsers to all of the very interesting, you know, investment information you can find there. We'll post the links everywhere. Dr. Stephen Lieb, we thank you so much.
Chris, thank you so much. It's always great, great talking to you. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. I watched with great enjoyment over Thanksgiving Mike Maloney's sixth installment of Hidden Secrets of Money and his follow-on discussion with Harry Dent. In particular, I appreciated how they zeroed in on a topic that has divided many in the gold camp for some time. The idea of inflation and deflation. Often, when these concepts are discussed, they are presented as standalone ideas in interviews and not as milestones on a continuum of economic chaos. Polarizing arguments tend to be made for one or the other, in that we will immediately leap into significant inflation or deflation, and that's that. Not for both occurring in succession and for specific durations of time as the economic reset occurs. That's what I came away with from these conversations. That first, there is a likelihood of significant deflation, which could last maybe a year or two, after which we will move into a significant inflationary period. It's a reasoned conversation, and one I suggest watching if you haven't done so already. One of the comments in the follow-up video conversation was that real estate could take upwards of another 60% hit in some locations. I personally do not doubt that. A cursory review of lending offers online will show you that we have already returned to the lax lending standards that contributed to the 2008 economic collapse. Stated income is now available again through certain mortgage brokers. Rent-to-own schemes are attempting to shield sellers of properties, mostly managed by law firms, by giving renters 4 years to qualify for a loan and putting a floor on the eventual purchase price of today's market value, and then increasing that eventual purchase price 2% each year until the renter ultimately qualifies for a loan. I wonder how many people they can shuffle into these kinds of loans before the floor once again drops out of real estate values. The bloodbath hasn't even started yet. Everyone who has bet on gold is right and needs to sit tight, because ultimately they will be rewarded. Because quantitative easing will not stop. It will flow into new and innovative sectors. Part of your long-term success strategy must include identifying those sectors and skating to where the puck is going to be, not where it has been. And until next time, this is Robert Ian, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.